Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
As country music develops, it seems to develop many different branches. One major branch is the Western form of country music. And I would suppose Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys count as somehow Western country.
Sure, that was Western swing music, and they
Western swing.
Yeah, and they were came out of the Texas, out of string music, but they always had fiddles in Texas, and they always played a little bit of a swing tune to it, and they love jazz, and they love big band jazz, which was part of the pop influence at the time, and they listened to Glenn Miller and they listened to Benny Goodman, and they wanted to sort of incorporate that into what they were doing. So Bob Wills never thought of himself as a country music artist; he was a swing jazz artist himself.
So why do you classify him as a country music artist?
Well, because of what he did had such a country background to it. Came out of string music. Now we look back on it, and it's influenced all the country musicians since then. So it's that's a sort of fluid part of country music. Not everybody who's considered country music always wanted to be that way. So
stay a little longer. That sounds to me, from the title, like a song that Willie does.
But Willie does that live almost every night.
It's the same song.
Sure, it is. Yeah, he's a big Bob Wills fan, So.
And did Wills write the song originally?
Yes, yeah.
Here it is.
To see my blue-eyed Sally, she lives way down on Shinbone Alley. The number on the gate, the number on the door, and the next house over is the grocery store.
Stay all night, stay a little longer, dance all night, dance a little longer, pull off your coat, throw it in the corner, don't see why you don't stay a little longer.
Singing to my love, the slop bucket fell from the window above. Mule in the grass, proper eating ice cream. Mule got sick and laid him on the beam.
Stay all night, stay a little longer. Dance all night, dance a little longer. Pull off your coat, throw it in the corner. Don't see why you don't stay a little longer. Washed out at the bottom of the hill, the big creek's up, the big creek's level, plow my corn with a double shovel.
Stay all night, stay a little longer, dance all night, dance a little longer, pull off the coat, throw it in the corner, don't see why you don't stay a little longer.
On the head, if you don't like biscuits, feed a cornbread. Girls on Big Creek about half grown, they jump on a man like a dog on a bone.
Stay all night, stay a little longer, dance all night, dance a little longer, pull off the coat, throw it in the corner, don't see why you don't stay a little longer.
What was that trumpet?
Exactly. It's funny because today people complain about country, pop influences and country music, but they were always there, and that's sort of an example of it. But that's as country as it gets, So.
This is way back. This is 1946.
Yes, exactly.
What did the war do to country music? We started with Jimmy Rogers, 1933, and that was Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, 1946.
Yes.
The war must have had some sort of influence.
Well, sure, and influenced bands, because a lot of the musicians went over and were soldiers. But I think it especially influenced it when they came back because there was so much more freedom. There was so much more traveling, cars, interstates and all that. So which sort of leads into the Hank Williams and movies and those kind of things, which had such, so country music went from this kind of folk music into a much broader, soldiers, took their country music over and played them for people who'd never heard it, and they had these guys playing songs for people in the North, and all of a sudden they were falling in love with these country songs where they'd never heard them before. So,
that's sort of in the Western style, or so we're told. At least they're called the Texas Playboys. And here's a great Western movie star who classifies, does he truly, as a country music singer.
Well, Gene Autry is definitely a country music singer, one of the most classic ones. But he also was a movie star, and he came out of the National Barn Dance in Chicago, which is one of the great. And Chicago was a great breeding ground for country music.
He came out of it. You mean he did that before he
Yeah, before movies? He became movies, he was he'd sang an audience. You know, he'd been in New York, and he's from Oklahoma and Texas, and he was born in Texas and been raised in Oklahoma, and had all these great, he'd performed in Oklahoma and Texas or New York before he came to Chicago. But by the time he came to Chicago, he became a star on the National Barn Dance, and that's where he sort of led to the movies from there, because they realized he had this great voice and this great style.
Well, it must have been quite early. This is actually also a recording from 1939.
Yeah, well, you know, the Barn Dance started in 24, so he was, he became...
Right here in Chicago, carried, right, I believe, on our sister's, or our competing station, WLS.
WLS was a huge, huge country music station that played for all the farmers, all through the Midwest, so...
And it lasted a long time.
It did. It lasted up to 1960, until rock and roll sort of took over.
I remember hearing it. I guess it must have been carried on network, because I remember hearing it as a kid in New York.
I did, yes. Yeah, yeah. I was on the radio networks, and then...
So here's Gene Autry, back in the saddle again.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly gypsum weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night and the only law is right. Back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-o, rocking to and fro, back in the saddle again. Whoopee-tie-i-a, I go my way, back in the saddle again. I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly jimson weed. I'm back in the saddle again, riding the range once more, toting my old 44, where you sleep out every night, and the only law is right.
Nashville, this is the year 1939. Nashville was not yet, in that time, the capital of country music.
No, not at all. No, there's certainly bands there, and the Opry had already started. Grand Ole Opry had started.
The National Barn Dance from Chicago was as big or bigger than the Opry.
It was. It preceded the Opry, And Judge Hay, who had been one of the main announcers and who came up with the name, the Grand Ole Opry, had come from the Barn Dance. They recruited him down to
And they did the Barn Dance publicly in theaters here in Chicago?
Well, they did it in the studios for a while, and then eventually, we wanted an audience, and you wanted people to respond to it, so they started taking it public from there. So but I think they were on Washington Boulevard for a while in the WLS studio. So
we're moving right along with all of this, but I think we'll hold off on the next one until after we take care of a newscast, which is coming in about a minute and a half. But let's talk a little bit about the business.
Okay.
We've mentioned Nashville, and of course you're based in Nashville, and that's where the great museum and Hall of Fame is.
Sure.
How does Nashville come to be the center, and when does it?
It was a progressive time, but at one point Roy Acuff and Fred Rose opened Acuff Rose Music Publishing. And as the Opry grew and became more important, the business kind of built around it. So publishing companies started. They started recording records there late 1940s. And WSM had their own studio and started recording artists. I think Eddie Arnold, who had always recorded in Chicago before that, was one of the first artists to record, some country hits in Nashville. And naturally it sort of grew. And then RCA Victor, which had been one of the main companies, opened a satellite office there. Decca Records, which became MCA, opened an office there. And it just sort of organically grew out of you know, really the Opry itself and WSM being such a big.
Roy Acuff was the MC, the host, the master of ceremonies in every way of Grand Ole Opry for many years, wasn't he?
Well, you know, a lot of their DJs were hosts, but Acuff was their biggest star. You know, yeah. And he was you know, for years and years. And a lot of times, most times, you know, you had bigger radio stars and you did record artists. You know, and Roy Acuff is definitely a huge radio artist and one of the best known people in America.
And I think he's probably the first country music star to run for governor.
Well, he may have been. You know, I don't know when Jimmy Davis
became governor.
Yeah, he became governor. Roy ran for a Tennessee governor on a Republican ticket and did not win. But Jimmy Davis did, you know, a couple times. So
we're about to pause for an update on the news, and then we come to what may be the greatest of all the figures in the earlier phase of the history of country music, Hank Williams.
Sure. Or maybe still the biggest artist ever, you know.
Still. So many years after his death. Sure. He died very young.
Yes, he did. 29 years
29.
Old. Yeah, so.
And his son, Hank Williams Jr., is around right now.
Yeah, who's now turned 60, I think. So he's,
directly onward and upward, Hank Williams, and we go on to Bill Monroe, who's a favorite with all sorts of people, including me, by all means. But first, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And Michael McCall is our guest tonight. He is staff writer and editor at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, where he is a man of all work when it comes to writing for the organization. And you are to be commended for this wonderful encyclopedia of country music. And this is an encyclopedia.
It is. It's pretty heavy, isn't it?
I'm giving it the heft test right now. It must weigh about 5 pounds.
Yeah, it's hard to carry.
And it has how many entries in all?
There's more than 1,200. You know, we've got about 1,260, I think we've figured. So,
Before we came on the air, I was looking up, with your assistance, some old friends, particularly Jethro Burns.
Sure, Homer and Jethro, yeah. And so
Jethro used to be on this program. He began doing it. He had retired to Chicago, and though he was still quite active and teaching mandolin to all sorts of eager young people.
Yeah, he had Chicago ties, and he just, you know, it's funny because he's such a comedian and comic artist, but both him and Homer and Jethro were both great musicians, and which made their comedians so much funny.
And they did sort of country music takeoffs on pop tunes.
Sure, and Jethro, Chet Atkins loved him, and he played with a lot of the great musicians. So,
but an even larger name in the history of country music is, of course, Hank Williams. What's to be said about him?
Well, Hank, the amazing thing was he didn't record until his first records were 1947. He died on New Year's Eve 1952. So in that short period, he created, just really what became, he became like the songwriter that everybody else was influenced by, not just in country music, I think, but rock, Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen and a lot of Van Morrison and a lot of great rock artists also looked to him as this writer who wrote from his heart. He was able to sort of take his life and start writing about what his experiences were and make them, catchy and universal for people.
Was his life a hardscrabble life from the South someplace?
It was, it's sometimes mischaracterized because I think he had a lot of fun and was a, joker and he had a family and he was, not always the person, not just a dark, conflicted character, but he did have, a lot of problems, through his life, and they grew as he got older, and I think he had some issues with being a star and making a lot of money, because he came from such poor circumstances,
But his early death wasn't brought on by any of those overindulgences. He died in an auto accident, didn't he?
No, he was in a car when he died, but he had a back problem, so he was taking morphine for the back problem, and he had been drinking.
Was he driving?
No, he was in the back seat. Yeah, he had an 18-year-old driver with him, and it was definitely an over. They say it was a heart. He died of a heart attack, but his heart stopped because of all the drugs and alcohol in his system. So.
Oh, it wasn't an auto accident.
No, it wasn't an accident at all.
So. I had that wrong. So really, a premature.
Yeah, death. It was. Yes, yeah.
Honky Tonk Blues.
Yeah, and the great thing about Honky Tonk Blues is it's sort of the signature song, one of his signature songs, but also so well explains this idea of a country boy trying to move beyond where he was from. I left my home on a rural route, and I told my dad I'm going stepping out, and his whole idea was that he was leaving town, he's going to go have a good time, but by the end of the song, he's wanting to go back home again, so it was this whole idea of that post-World War II era with country boys were leaving and going to the cities, but also missing home, and then a lot of the sort of conflicts that were going on in their minds, and it captures that idea so perfectly. So
here he is.
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill, he sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low, I'm so lonesome I could cry.
Now, that's a great Hank
First
Williams
disaster
song.
Of the evening.
That's yeah, not, that's not a great song. That's a great Hank Williams song. It's "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry."
Yeah,
and one of the best songs he ever wrote. You know, but it's a different song than we were talking about.
But I wonder how it got on the. Was you supplied the disc?
No, yeah. I sent up the songs, but not the disc itself. So.
Oh, yeah. Then somebody else made a mistake. Yes. I don't. We're getting a consult from Aubrey Bumpower after I put on my earphones. We are getting Honky Tonk Blues, I'm told.
There we go.
Here it is.
Well, I left my home down on the rural route. I told my pa I'm going stepping out and get the Honky Tonk Blues. Hey, the Honky Tonk Blues. Hey, Lord, I got 'em. I got the Honky Tonk Blues. Shoes. Woke up this morning wishing I could lose them jumping honky tonk blues. Hey, the honky tonk blues. Oh, Lord, I got them. I got the honky tonk blues. Honky-tonk blues. Hey, the honky-tonk blues. Hey, Lord, I got 'em. I got the honky-tonk blues. I'm gonna tuck my worries underneath my arm and scat right back to my pappy's farm and leave his honky-tonk blues. Hey, the honky-tonk blues. Oh, Lord, I got 'em. I got the honky tonk blues.
Well, we recovered.
You can hear a little yodel in Hank's voice too, like we talked about.
Yeah, so. That's the mistake is not your fault. Apparently, you sent up the list, but it was put together here. And
they're both great songs.
And one of our new interns, obviously, messed it up just a little, but that's what interns do. He will learn as he continues. I was remembering a great Hank Williams song, "Walking the Floor Over You." Isn't that it?
That's Ernest Tubb. Yeah,
was
but
that
that's
Tubb?
Yeah, but that's one of Hank's big influences. Yeah, so.
I thought that was it. I thought that was by him.
Yes. Yeah, so.
Walking the Floor Over You.
Yeah, but you can hear that.
A wink,
you,
that is true.
Yeah, it's funny because you can hear that in that song almost. You know, because that you would think that because that was
Ernest Tubb is a great performer.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it was, and he was one of Hank's heroes. You know, so
yeah. We come to the invention of bluegrass.
Sure.
I had always thought that bluegrass was there from the very beginning, long before we called it country music, that it has strong antecedents in the Scotch-Irish tradition. But
right.
That's not so.
Well, you know, it does have those influences, I think, and but it was different until Bill Monroe got a hold of it.
What did he do with it?
He sped it up, and he tightened it up at the same time.
Yeah.
Just really great musicianship.
Tightened up the rhythm, but also tightened up the harmony.
Tightened up the harmonies, yeah, very, yeah. Brought in, you know, really strong, tight harmonies.
Yeah.
Really great at musicianship. And especially when once Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs joined the band with Scruggs, you know, great banjo style, which was revolutionary.
The instrumentation is always the same.
Well, you know, people can argue about that, but people like to think that bluegrass should have a banjo and should have a mandolin and a fiddle in it. Yeah. So
and a bass.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what we have right here.
Yeah. Sure. And harmony singing always. You know. So yes.
And with the bluegrass.
This really shows how fast they could play. And a song called Heavy Traffic Ahead, and it's
by the way, what was his Chicago association?
Well, Bill Monroe lived in Gary, Indiana for a while, and that one recorded in
your hometown.
In my hometown, exactly, yeah. And he came up and played played there and around the clubs and on radio. He came to Chicago and played a lot, and that was with the Monroe Brothers before he performed the Bluegrass Boys. But that was a big part of his past. So,
and here they are. Well, we're fade on that one. I'm afraid the recording isn't too good. That's probably from a live performance.
Yeah, it sounds like an outtake or a
sounds
live
a little
performance.
Staticky, actually. And we are a bit overdue for a round of commercials. So here, with lesser musical quality, are the commercials.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We've reached sort of mid-phase in our playlist. Are we mid-phase in the development of country music?
I think pretty close. Yeah, we're up to 1958, so what we're 30 something years into it. And
how does it diffuse? With whom is it really popular by that time?
Well, I think in the 50s was we're catching a time now where country with Hank Williams had really hit a peak at some point, and then of course rock and roll happened in the mid 50s, and that siphoned off a lot of especially the younger fans found and rock and roll was very country influenced, and so certainly Elvis and Jerry Lee and Lewis and Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash obviously were very country influenced, but so country had to change a little bit at that point, and Nashville was one of the sort of leaders in that. And one of the reasons Nashville is what it is today is it sort of reacted to the rock influence by a couple of things. One of them was to make a sort of Nashville sound, as they call it, which is sweeter, and then
it's more orchestral. It
brought in, instead of fiddles, it brought in orchestras and string sections. It added, instead of the sort of high harmonies, it added sort of vocal groups, very smooth harmonies in the background. But very melodic songs, very, well-performed songs. The bands were great. The singers were all great. They really highlighted the vocals and the melodies.
Something we haven't talked about at all is the thematic content of country music. It seems to me there are three or four major themes. One is lost love, and very often it's illicit love, that is, cheating on the side.
It's funny because I think one of the things about country music, it's about responsibility and consequences, and morality, where rock and roll is about, sort of fantasy and pushing, limits of country, sort of the grounded part of it, what happens afterwards. And
another theme that you get is sort of nostalgia for the old folks at home, so to speak.
Yeah, a lot
for
of
the
family.
The simple way of life in the country and the family,
family
and the church and so on.
Gospel community, is, even when I talk about Hank Williams, wanting to leave town, the by the end of the song, he's wanting to go back. He's missing his family. He's missing his community. So I think a lot of country deals with that, the sort of basic part of America and working, especially working people, that sometimes you, as you're young, you want to leave. And sometimes as you get older, you want to go back, So
there's a lot of love in these songs, a lot of songs about love. Is there happy love, fulfilled and contented love?
Oh, sure. Sure. There's a lot of, happy love songs. I think sometimes people get attracted to the idea of the songs that are about heartbreak, because we all go through it, and there's a certain drama that comes into that in the same way. Movies are about, drama more than happiness sometimes.
When you mention heartbreak, that suddenly brings to mind Heartbreak Hotel, which brings to mind Elvis Presley.
Sure.
Do we count Presley as a country singer?
Well, he's in the Country Music Hall of Fame, and he had a lot of country hits. And Elvis always thought of himself as, he was very country. He loved the Grand Ole Opry, and then the country was a big, his first single, had a blues song on one side and a Blue Moon Road song on B side. Uh-huh. He did Blue Moon in Kentucky as his first one of his first singles. So he always loved country music. And I think he was disappointed that when he came to the Opry, and the Opry thought he was a little bit too wild for them, you know, because they were a very conservative place. And you know, and he was very happy, you know, later in his career when country music came back to him and started playing the songs. So,
now picking up on this on the playlist again, we come to Don Gibson. I really don't know much about him.
Well, Don Gibson was, you know, out of East Tennessee. He was a really great songwriter. You know, wrote great songs like "Sweet Dreams," the famous Patsy Cline song that Fern Young and others had recorded.
"Sweet Dreams of You." That's a gorgeous production.
Yes. Yeah. And he was, you know, Chet Atkins really loved Don Gibson. He recorded them. And "No Lonesome Me" was sort of a boogie song that, you know, but they weren't quite getting it right. Mm-hmm. And Chet said, "Let's try something different." And they made it sweeter. You know, they added background harmonies and they added strings to it. And it made it a completely different song than Don had written at the beginning. But it was it became a huge hit because of it. And Don, you know, went along with it and loved it, too. And it was sort of part of Chet Atkins' genius, was able to take songs and find a way of broadening their context. So.
Atkins, of course, is commonly known as a great guitarist.
Exactly.
But in fact, he was also a great producer, wasn't he?
Yeah, yes. You know, nowadays, he's such a great guitarist that his influence these days, I think, is still seen as this outstanding guitarist. But in Nashville, he was an outstanding record executive and producer as well. Yeah. And he made so many, you know, shaped so many careers and worked with some, you know, found so many great talents. So
let's hear then Don Gibson, "Oh Lonesome Me," recorded in 1958.
Everybody's going out and having fun. I'm just a fool to stay home having none. I can't get over how she set me free. That mistake I'm making by just hanging around. I know that I should have some fun and paint the town. I look so cool, that's blind, I just can't see. Oh, lonesome me. I'll bet she's not like me. She's out of fancy paint. She's the bird with the boys with all her charm. I still love her so, and brother, don't you know, I'd welcome her right back here in my arms. There must be some way I can lose these lonesome blues, forget about the past and find somebody new. I've thought of everything to make me see. She's not like me. She's out of fancy free. She's purple with the boys with all her charm. I still love her so. And brother, don't you know, I'd welcome her right back here in my arms. There must be some way I can lose these lonesome blues, forget about the past and find somebody new. I've thought of everything to make see. Oh, lonesome me. Oh, lonesome me.
That has a great swing to it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a swing song, but also has the, you know, the harmonies. And, you know, mm-hmm. there's a banjo in there, you know, but he's but you can hear how he'd sweetened it a little bit, you know, and then broadened it out from what country music had been.
It sounds pretty conventional, actually.
Sure.
I mean, it sounds
now,
like good.
Now, you know, but at that time it was a little different.
Well, that was a breakthrough.
Yeah, sure.
When it was done.
Sure.
With all that instrumentation.
Right.
I see. I want to go quickly to the next one to work it in before we stop for a newscast. So just a word or two about Buck Owens and "Love's Gonna Live Here."
Well, you know, Buck Owens was out of Bakersfield, and at the same time, Nashville had just become a huge recording center. Hollywood had always been a big center before that. And Bakersfield became the second one. So he had Merle Haggard, and Buck Owens was the first one. You know, a lot of other artists, Gene Shepherd for a Husky came out of Vaughn and Jackson, came out of Bakersfield. And they were a little rawer. They brought in the Fender guitar because that was created in California.
Uh-huh.
And it was just a little more beat to it, you know, and it was, you know, it was sort of counter, you know, a little bit counter to what Nashville was doing.
So. This is 1966. Buck Owens, Love's Gonna Live Here.
Oh, the sun's gonna shine in my life once more.
And from that, we segue directly to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Michael McCall, our live guest in studio tonight, is one of the editors, together with Paul Kingsbury and John Rumble, of the Great Encyclopedia of Country Music, the second edition, compiled by the staff, and he and his two colleagues are of the staff, of the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. And that's published by, that's Oxford University Press.
Oxford University Press has been a great partner with us on
it,
yes.
So they take it, that shows you that this is very serious stuff.
Yeah, you know, they're a great reference book, among other things, a publisher, you know, and they've been great to work with.
Of course,
you've
got lots of writers in here who are well-known for their connections one way or another.
Sure, yeah, we have a lot of scholars and journalists and you know, country music experts, even musicians who contributed to
and
it.
And I note that one of them is John Lomax III. That's yes. A very interesting name in connection with the origins of this music.
Sure, both his, you know, John Lomax and Alan Lomax, John Lomax Jr. and Alan Lomax were great field historians yeah. and recorders of blues and country music.
For the Library of Congress.
Exactly, yes.
Way back in the 20s and 30s.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So yeah, on through the 50s and too. Yeah, they were very influential. So
Leadbelly, the great folk artist,
yeah, that's one of them, yeah,
was
so.
Found by Alan Lomax in prison down in Louisiana, and he helped to get him out of prison.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. We go back to the music, back to the playlist, and this is the point at which one say, let us join the ladies.
Yeah, you know, we've skipped the Carter family earlier, which had, you know, such a female influence. But, you know, and females have always been important in country music, but not maybe as until, you know, 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. Kitty Wells, of course, Patsy Montana had a big hit. Kitty Wells, Patsy Cline. We're going to play Loretta Lynn, who I think in the 60s, along with Dolly Parton, really started representing, you know, what the female point of view in writing. You know, Kitty Wells had some, but Loretta sort of took it, you know, into the 60s when females were starting to assert themselves. Women were starting to assert themselves a little more in life, and
so their
and
songs,
kind of music represented it.
Their yeah, songs so. Relate to their being women.
Sure, exactly. Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a song about being a wife and then talking back to your husband about what he was doing. So.
You Ain't Woman Enough to Take My Man is the title.
Yes.
Explain.
You know, it's a song about her husband cheating on her and her talking to the woman who was, you know, the mistress, I guess, you know, yeah. the woman that was being cheating with, and she's talking directly to her, you know, saying that she's going to fight for her husband and keep him, you know, and that you know, she's a better woman than I'm a better woman than you are.
Yeah.
And my husband's not going to go with you. He's going to stay with me. You know, that's sort of what she's saying. But it's, you know, it's just such a spirited song, and it's a little tongue in cheek, I think, because Retta had a sense of humor. But it's real life too. You know, her husband had, you know, some issues, and it was part of her way of dealing with it was writing.
Oh, really?
About it. Yeah. So
this reflects her.
It does. Yeah. Yeah.
Her marital situation.
Yeah, a little bit. Yes.
Interesting. Here it is. Yeah, that's a mood or a style in country music that you hear a lot of, but that's the first time we've had it tonight. That is something about troubled marriage, but I'm going to stay with you anyway.
Yes, yeah, yeah. You think of Stand By Your Man, and which is sometimes misinterpreted.
Who's the woman who sings Stand By Your Man?
Tammy Wynette.
That's Tammy Wynette. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and I think, you know, these are all songs from the 60s, and there were women, you know, as culture was changing, they felt like they could, you know, able to speak out a little more and you know, the women were sort of rising in society and culture, and country music was reflecting that. So.
We're well into the 60s, and now going into the 70s, here's a man who's a true artist, not only for this one song, which was very well known, but for all the other narrative songs that he's developed.
Yeah.
Tom T. Hall.
Yeah, you know, and Tom T. was from Kentucky, you know, and he was, you know, wasn't educated, you know, classically, you know, he grew up in bluegrass and everything, but he was self-educated and became just one of the most literary writers in Nashville. And he's part of a sort of a movement with Kris Kristofferson and Mick Newberry and a lot of other great writers during that time.
When Brahms wrote them, they called them art songs.
Yeah.
In a way, this is an art song.
Yeah, it's a narrative art song.
It's a narrative art song.
Yeah.
Very much in the American style and in the American idiom. And it's just beautiful stuff. And without further ado, as they say, old dogs and children and watermelon wine.
How old do you think I am? He said. I said, well, I didn't know. He said, I turned 65 about 11 months ago. I was sitting in Miami pouring blended whiskey down when this old gray black gentleman was cleaning up the lounge. There wasn't anyone around except this old man and me. The guy who ran the bar was watching Ironsides on TV. Uninvited, he sat down and opened up his mind on old dogs and children and watermelon wine. Ever had a drink of watermelon wine? He asked. He told me all about it, though I didn't answer back. Ain't but three things in this world that's worth a solitary dime, but old dogs and children and watermelon wine. He said women think about themselves when menfolk ain't around, and friends are hard to find when they discover that you're down. He said I tried it all when I was young and in my natural prime. Now it's old dogs and children and watermelon wine. Old dogs care about you even when you make mistakes. God bless little children while they're still too young to hate. When he moved away, I found my pen and copied down that line about old dogs and children and watermelon wine. I had to catch a plane up to Atlanta that next day. As I left for my room, I saw him picking up my change. That night I dreamed in peaceful sleep of shady summertime, of old dogs and children and watermelon wine.
That's just perfect.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Really great. And you were telling me while we were listening about his current activity. He's still quite active.
He's still a writer. He still writes actively. Mm-hmm. Writes bluegrass. People record his songs a lot now because he's a big bluegrass fan. He goes a lot of he travels around with them and goes to festivals, and he loves writing bluegrass
and
songs.
And does he still perform?
He does. Well, and not, you know, he calls himself retired. You know, every once in a while he'll get out and do this thing. He did we had him at the Hall of Fame for a artist in residence series a few years ago. And, you know, so we try to bring in people like that. He's still, every once in a while he will. So.
One of my favorites is up next after we pause for a quick round of commercials, and that is Kenny Rogers in a song which is just as inventive and just as perfectly wrought.
Exactly, yeah. Still a narrative song. It's more of a crossover song, you know, became a pop song, but it was just as much a narrative. Yes.
And it's The Gambler, which we'll hear right after we first hear this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And I'm very eager to get now to Kenny Rogers, another great songwriter with wonderful narrative.
Yeah, and Kenny didn't write this. A guy named Don Schlitz wrote this song. It was the first song he ever had cut, you know. But Kenny did such. You know, Kenny is such a great singer, you know, and so good at telling stories in his songs. So.
And this has really put something into the language, I think. You got to know when to hold them, know when to
That's
fold
right.
them. Has become sort of a general bit of folk wisdom that
right, exactly.
you can trot out.
You're exactly right. So,
you tell a friend who's in a bad relationship. You got to know where to hold them, know where to fold them.
It works in business. It works in a lot of
or
business, sports or a lot
whatever,
of things. Yeah. So.
Here it is, Kenny Rogers. This is 1978, The Gambler.
warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns of staring out the window at the darkness till boredom overtook us. And he began to speak. He said, "Son, I've made a life out of reading people's faces, knowing what the cards were by the way they held their eyes. So if you don't mind my saying, I can see you're out of aces. For a taste of your whiskey, I'll give you some advice." So I handed him my bottle, and he drank down my last swallow. Then he bummed a cigarette and asked me for a light. And the night got deathly quiet, and his face lost all expression. Said, "If you're gonna play the game, boy, you gotta learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done." Every gambler knows that the secret to surviving is knowing what to throw away, knowing what to keep. 'Cause every hand's a winner and every hand's a loser, and the best that you can hope for is to die in your sleep. And when he finished speaking, he turned back toward the window, crushed out his cigarette, faded off to sleep. And somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. But in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting be time enough to count when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold up, when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough to count when the deal is done.
Wonderful.
Yeah, not great.
Truly wonderful. Now, you have indulged me, and we're now going to hear the one song that I have put into the playlist tonight.
Good.
And I've done it sort of on impulse, as you heard me. I asked your permission, and you have graciously allowed me to do this. Here's a guy that I know. I count him as something of a friend. He's been on the program a number of times, though not in the last 2 or 3 years, and I got to get him back here again sometime soon. A fabulous character named Kinky Friedman.
Sure.
He went to school at the University of Texas, as I remember it, and he put together this outfit known as Kinky Friedman and his Texas Jew Boys.
Yeah.
Half of them were, in fact, Jewish. Half of them were not, but he made them honorary Jews.
Right.
And he's using country music and its style in a rather a roustabout, noisy,
sure,
but really quite musical way. But many of the themes, not all, but many of them, relate, in fact, to things that Jewish people are concerned about.
Yeah.
He's got one about the Holocaust,
yeah,
which is actually a horrible, right, horrifying and very moving story. This one is, I think, his best known piece. Of course, he hasn't. The Texas Jew Boys disbanded many years ago, I think. They were really busy in the 70s and early 80s.
Yeah, you know, there was a whole movement out of Texas of all these great songwriters who were taking a lot of chances and pushing voters in a lot of different ways, and all from their own personal viewpoint.
And
Kinky is certainly
Kinky
from his.
Yeah, so. He went on to become a very successful mystery writer.
Yes. And ran for governor a couple
and
times.
And ran for governor in Texas. And was taken seriously.
Well, he started off satirical like he always does and ends up being taken serious, which is sort of his history. You know?
But here, in a wonderfully turned phrase and a wonderfully turned idea, is Kinky Friedman and the Texas Jew Boys, and they ain't making Jews like Jesus anymore.
Well, a redneck nerd in a bowling shirt was a guzzling Lone Star beer, talking religion and a politics for all the world to hear. They ought to send you back to Russia, boy, or New York City one. You just want to doodle a Christian girl and you killed God's only son. I said, has it occurred to you, you nerd, that that's not very nice? We Jews believe it was Santa Claus that killed Jesus Christ. You know, you don't look Jewish, he said, near as I could figure. I had you lamped for a slightly anemic, well-dressed country nigger. No, they ain't making Jews like Jesus anymore. They don't turn the other cheek the way they done before. He started into shouting and spitting on the floor. Lord, they ain't making Jews like Jesus anymore. He says, I ain't a racist, but Aristotle Onassis is one Greek we don't need. And them niggers, Jews, and Sigma Nus, all they ever do is breathe. And Wops and Mix and Slopes and Spicks and Spooks are on my list. And there's one little heap from the heart of Texas. Is there anyone I miss? Well, I hits him with everything I had right square between the eyes. I says, I'm gonna get you, son of a bitch, you spouting that pack of lies. If there's one thing I can't abide, it's an ethnocentric racist. Now you take back that thing you said about Aristotle Onassis. And all the making Jews like Jesus anymore. We don't turn the other cheek the way we've done before. You could hear that honky holler as he hit that hardwood floor. Lord, they sure ain't making Jews like Jesus anymore. All right.
Necessary fate. Also, it's necessary for me to say, because I'd forgotten all the details of the lyric. Obviously, when he uses the N-word and various others like Hebe and so on, he's attributing those to the man that he calls the ethnocentric racist.
Right, right. It's all written from the point of view of somebody that is racist.
He's satirizing and condemning this stupid guy in the bar uses the N-word and speaks of chinks and whatever and so on. So, and it's a very effective tune.
Yeah, I think there was a great time in the 70s where so many songwriters were pushing, boundaries and writing about things that, they weren't always played on the radio very much, but they're very effective songwriters.
Well, I'd forgotten just where that lyric went, so we were a little surprised on hearing it, because I just, on impulse, told our producer, Trey, to dig it up, and he did.
Yeah, well, it's a great song.
But it's a great song, and we must have played it at least once when Kinky was here before, so. We're not setting new records. I think it's a real killer of a tune because it has political purpose.
Yeah, and, it comes out of, you can hear that time almost talking blues, like Woody Guthrie and, and a lot of those writers who came out of, that tradition of folk music.
And in American politics, around the wars particularly, we're going to hear some of this later, in fact, aren't we?
Yes.
Very strong songs, full of anger, either about those who are disloyal to the war or those who make war.
Sure. Yeah. Country music has always reacted to wars. It's hard to sometimes characterize country music politically, but one thing you can always count on is if there is a war, there will be some angry songs that come out because there's that, it's their sons and their brothers and their, fathers who are going off to war.
We're going to come to that shortly. In fact, with Merle Haggard.
Yes.
And if we can work it in, and we must be sure we do, the Dixie Chicks.
Sure.
All to follow after we pause for an update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Before we say another word, before we do anything else, let me invite telephone calls. The lines are open, 312-591-7200. We're working a few calls. Get in there quickly if you want to be heard. 312-591-7200. A little bit more music that we want to transact as well. But even more important is the availability of this great encyclopedia of country music. I suppose it could be bought in bookstores, but they can get it directly off your website.
Yeah, you can buy it at the countrymusichalloffame.org website. We have it for sale in a museum store. If you become a member of a museum, you get a discount on it. But it's also available, you know, through bookstores and Amazon and other places too. So.
But the internet location, countrymusichalloffame.org.
Yes.
And what else do they find on the site?
Oh, yeah, it's a museum store. We've got posters, records, books, anything related with country music. You know, you can buy clothes there. It's a great museum store.
I want to read you an email that came in from a regular listener of ours who's located in Sydney, Australia. And he asks an interesting question, as soon as I can bring it up, which I have not yet done, but it is coming in just a moment. And here we go. I should have had this all done before. My apologies, but here it is. Is Mr. McCall familiar with the fantastic soundtrack to Robert Altman's film Nashville? No doubt the director and his cast, who all had a hand in writing their respective numbers, were somewhat leaning toward a cynical view of the country and Western genre, yet they still managed to score memorable and even poignant songs. I could watch that film over and over just for the music. Highest regards, Mike in Sydney.
Yeah, I think he's right. There were some great songs down there, including Keith Carradine's
"I'm
Not Easy." Yeah,
sort of blasted.
So, yeah, Ronnie Blakely, you know, who was a great, ended up being doing albums in country music, who played sort of a Loretta Lynn kind of character in the movie. But it's I think that movie captured a certain part of Nashville. It was satirical in a way, but it sort of captured that mixture of art and enterprise, and the idea of people coming to Nashville, the young people who are trying to change, who had their own sort of younger, more rebellious sort of idea of things, but also how the established stars sort of have this, very...
Well, how does country music rank among the industries that flourish in Nashville? Is it the second or third leading industry of the town?
Well, Nashville's a pretty diverse town. It has a lot of banking and other kinds of publishing.
Two fine universities.
Yeah, two fine universities, exactly. And it's a very, cosmopolitan and corporate town. In a lot of ways, a lot of insurance companies as well.
Mm-hmm.
Country music is probably the best known export of it,
sure.
In the industry there. It's the thing that's known worldwide, and it's probably the main reason people come and visit Nashville. There are other reasons, but I think they come there to see country music and to visit the Country Music Hall of Fame and to see the Grand Ole Opry. And then there's so many other things once you get there that you live music and the things you can visit, it's a real rich experience.
And you say that it flourishes worldwide. In fact, you've got American country music written and performed in Australia and other such places.
Well, there you go. We had a writer, like you said, from Australia today, and that's it goes, Japan is a huge country music market.
Really?
Love it there. Yeah, so, and there's a lot of big tourists go over there.
Do they do their own in Japanese?
There are great Japanese fiddle players, and honky-tonkers, but they haven't broken out nationally or internationally that way, but they love having people come over there and play and seeing the real thing, as does many countries in Europe.
We come to the issue of political argument in the form of country music.
Yes.
And Merle Haggard, he's done a few songs which are really very opposed to those who oppose war.
Yeah, but I think in the 60s, especially when during the Vietnam War, split. And I think
Okie from Muskogee
was one of them. Fight Inside of Me was another one. I think Merle's politics aren't as delineated as that may sound, because he's not just always, also world song, more recently supporting Hillary Clinton, So he's always had a lot of different views, but he's very passionate about it. And I think at that time, coming out of the working class that he did, he just didn't like seeing America put down in the way that he felt
his
it was.
So. Fight Inside of Me, recorded in 1970.
Yeah.
That's... The Vietnam War is still going.
Sure was.
But it's not in good shape.
Right.
I hear people talking bad about the way they have to live here in this country. Our on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. They're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims that he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. And when they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. They're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
And I suppose we should hear, it isn't the response to it because it was done so many years later, Dixie Chicks, Not Ready to Make Nice, done only a few years ago, 2006. All the same, give us the background on that one.
Well, you know, what had happened is that Dixie Chicks said, you know, I think country artists have this relationship with their art audience and fans. They feel like they can be themselves and say what they feel. And the Dixie Chicks were in a concert where the singer Natalie Maines had spoken out. She was against, you know, the invasion of Iraq and spoke out about President Bush. And just said, you know, she said she was embarrassed that he was from Texas, which is where she was from. And but the reaction to it, because of the timing of it, I think, because we're about to go to war, that a lot of country radio stations and some country fans rebelled against it. They had a huge career and a huge fan base before that. So this was sort of reaction to how they were reacted to. You know, so many people burned their records and those kinds of things. And they you know, didn't back down in the long run. You know, they sort of said, you know, that they were upset at how they weren't able to sort of speak their mind about it, you know. And this is sort of their response song. And it won a Grammy. So it also sold a couple million records.
And they're not ready to make nice, meaning I'm not going to play your game.
Right, exactly.
I oppose the administration, I'm going to say so.
I'm going to say so, yeah.
But, you know, even if the other country.
Which is an American thing, we should all speak out.
Even if the other country music people are offended.
Yeah, and even if it hurt their career within country music, not necessarily outside of it, you know. So,
did it hurt their career?
It stopped them being played on country radio as much as they had been. Yes.
Really?
Yes.
And does that persist as a kind of a blackout even now?
Well, you know, they've sort of, you know, both of, a lot of them got married and had children after that, and they sort of haven't. Yeah, so that was the last record they've done now.
Uh-huh.
Since then, I think they're getting ready to do another one. And you know, they've, two of the sisters in the band have formed another band and done well with that, called the Courtyard Hounds.
But here they are at their height or in their biggest trouble.
Sure.
Dixie Chicks, Not Ready to Make Nice.
Still for me to figure out. I've paid a price, and I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. I probably wouldn't if I could, 'cause I'm mad as hell. Can't bring myself to do what it is you think I should. I know you said, can't you just get over it? It turned my whole world around, and I kinda like it. Made my bed and I sleep like a baby with no regrets, and I don't mind saying.
Necessary fade, we're almost out of time. You know, it occurs to me, they must have had in mind the scene from the film Network, where the guy tells all the country to shout, I'm mad as hell and I won't
take it. I'm not taking it anymore, that's right, yeah. And I think that's how they felt, you know. I think they had been big stars in country music and had been supported, and they felt like, you know, over one thing that they spoke out about that they were...
You've got a chapter in the second edition of the Encyclopedia about the political side of country music.
Yeah, there's 14 essays in the... Encyclopedia about different aspects of country music, and the two new ones that we did were The Fighting Side of Me, we called it, the Politics of Country Music, which goes all the way back from, you know, the 20s, you know, through modern times and Toby Keith and people like that, about songs that were written about politics and in reaction to what's the social stuff that's going on in the United States. And the other new essay was on sort of the digital, how country music has changed with the digital times, you know, and the internet, and responded to that and continues to change. So
we're going to pause right now. We got a last round of commercials to make up, and then on to the phones for the few minutes available. We've got room on the board. If you want to be heard, get in there instantly. 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. We look forward to your calls, and we'll try to get to them right after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And back to Michael McCall and on to the phones, 312-591-7200. Here's Wayne, someplace in Ontario. Where are you?
In Brantford, Ontario, where the telephone was invented. I am visually impaired, and I'm a retired country music entertainer. I really have enjoyed this. However, I don't like where country music is going right now because it's too watered down. I mean, I think we could still have traditional country music to sell, and I know because Ellen Jackson, George Strait, some of those artists like that are doing it. They're keeping it country, and they are selling.
Watered down.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, and in some ways, I think you mean like polished and slicked up, and also has a lot of, you know, rock and pop influences in it. There are, I think, like you said, Ellen Jackson and George Strait, and a lot of, or a handful of traditional artists who sort of keep that alive. And I think, you know, through country music history, there's always been that sort of tug of war between people who are, you know, trying to make it pop more popular and mm-hmm. extend the audience, and those who are traditionalists, you know, and draw more on you know, the history of it, and then sort of a more basic folk
based song. Traditionalist.
Yeah, well, I understand. I am too, and I love that music, you know. But you know, it seems to be a pendulum sometimes, you know, where it goes back and forth, and we're in a pop swing right now. But there's also, you know, if you look for it, there's some really great country music out there. It's just not always what you hear on the radio.
There's a Canadian country music scene as well as the one from Nashville, I gather.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about it.
Well, there's people like Stompin' Tommy Connors up here, and of course, Gordon Lightfoot is, he might be considered a folk artist, but a lot of what he wrote has been recorded by country music
sure.
people like George Hamilton IV.
Yeah, Waylon Jennings did some of his songs, too. Sure.
Very well, yes. Uh-huh. Even Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs cut some of his songs.
Yeah, and there's guys, younger guys like Cor Blond and you know, Fred Eaglesmith, who I think is a great songwriter out of Canada, you know. So there's Canadian artists who, in some ways, are sometimes more traditional than what you
Ian
hear
Tyson.
Out of Nashville. Ian Tyson always is great, yes.
Very good case in point.
A good cowboy singer.
Yes.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Very, very glad to have heard from you. 312-591-7200. What is the... what's the size of the audience? How much is sold? You know, how does country music compare to whatever all the rest of music, popular music, is in terms of its commercial significance?
It certainly competes with pop and rock and R&B music. I think there's more country radio stations almost than any other than maybe talk show stations right now in the country. It's a very popular thing to listen to on radio.
Is it more popular still in the South than elsewhere in the country?
Well, you know, it's probably a little more popular there, but it has, I think any part of the country has a mm-hmm. country radio station, and they're all always one of the top stations in the market, you know. So, you know, and some of that translates to sales, and some of it, you know, people just love listening to it, so it depends on who the listener is. But it's, you know, the sales, you know, obviously Taylor Swift is, considered a country artist, and she's one of the top-selling artists in the country mm-hmm. right now. And there's several others in that, you know, there were still million sellers at a time when records aren't selling like they used to, so.
Back to the phones, and here is Bob, who joins us. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. It's a very good show, very good presentation, by the way, Michael McCall. Calling from just outside Chicago, there's one thing you may know as you're a historian, but one thing that is attributed to Buck Owens is the phrase called chicken picking.
Right. James Burton, you know, one of the great guitar players, but... was one of the guys who you know, did that on Telecaster so well.
I think he's, I mean, I don't know if he started, but that's who I associate with it.
Yeah, he's sort of one of the most outstanding versions of it. You know, Roy Nichols and some of the other guys who played with Merle, played Merle, but also Buck, you know, had Don Rich, who could do it very well. But so many of them came out of California because of Fender.
That may have been who it was. Who it was actually, Don Rich. I'm not sure. You probably know more than I.
Yeah, Don Rich played with Buck, you know, and had those really great leads that you hear on all of his songs. But he occasionally brought Burton into the studio with him, as did Merle, you know, the Mama Tried, which has that great opening Fender part. So James Burton playing.
Yeah. Definitely a great player. All right, thank you.
Sure.
We thank you, sir.
Thank you, too. Sir.
And let's work in one more quick call. Stephen is next. Good evening, sir.
Hi, Milt. I grew up in the 40s, 50s. My dad was a riverboat piano player, and I remember a song. In fact, it's in my repertoire. I sing it all the time. It's called "I Got an Empty Saddle and a Worn-Out Bridle. In my stable, there's an empty stall." But I can't remember the artist.
You know, I don't know exactly. I've heard that song before, but I can't say who originated it. But if you know, leave your name with us and I'll look it up for you and then let you know. So.
All right, thanks. The other one quick question I have is, what's your opinion of Ricky Nelson? I always thought "Hello, Mary Lou" and "Garden Party" were great songs.
Yeah, you know, that's a great transition because James Burton came to fame by playing with Ricky Nelson. Ricky found him in Louisiana and brought him to live with the Nelson family when he was 15, 16 years old to California. And a lot of those, you know, and Ricky is such a great singer. But a lot of the greatness of those records was also James's guitar playing on them, And yeah, I think he's underrated in a way. I think he's a, you know, both a great pop and country singer, and he went into country more as he aged. And Garden Party is a great example of that.
Thank you, sir.
We thank you, sir, for the call, and we're going to go out with some music.
Right, good gospel songs. So.
This is Red Foley.
We always end country concerts with gospel songs, right? So.
This is Red Foley, "Peace in the Valley." Yes.
Oh well, I'm tired.
All right, then with that, I'll say goodnight and thank you most sincerely to Michael McCall.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. You've been great.
And thanks to all for listening. Stay with Red Foley, and we'll be with you again tomorrow night at 11 rather than at 10. And until then, a most cordial good night to all.
Well, the morning's so bright, and the lamb is the light, and the night is as black as the sea. Oh, yes.
There will be peace in the valley for me someday.
There will be peace in the valley for me. Oh, Lord, I pray.
There'll be no sadness, no sorrow,
oh, Molly,
no trouble I see.
There will be peace in the valley for me. Bear will be gentle, and the wolf